Welcome back to the Doubters, everybody. This is Thursday, the 16th of April, and welcome to the people who are joining us online here today, live, and also welcome to the new people who signed up to the community and who may be listening to this recording. And today, I've got a very special guest, and it's Michael Leckie. He's joining us from Connecticut. That's all right, isn't it, Connecticut?
Yep.
Michael, yeah, how's life in Connecticut with you at the moment then?
Well, you know, I mean, given the pandemic, that could be better. But other than that, the weather looks like it'll be decent today. So I've got a little light in my home office here, and you know, we're weathering it fine, kind of staying in and getting things done.
Staying in, hunkering down. I should imagine you're doing lots of writing your book.
Yeah, I have been doing some writing, and there's been a lot of client work as well. The situation actually for most of my active clients has made life busier for them. Some of them are in the food industry and the supply chain, and others are, you know, have products that you know, are needed in the marketplace. So they've just gotten busier, and as they've gotten busier, I've gotten busier. But I'm certainly happy to be busy as opposed to not being working like so many people unfortunately are at this time.
Yeah, that's great. It was great you're managing to keep up with everything. I'm just noticing that you are cutting out a little bit, but we're managing to get you. I don't think it's a sound. I think it's a connection. I think it's a connection. But anyway, I think we'll be right. We had a massive technical hitch last week. My guests chopped out all completely, and then I banned them from the session. I managed to remove them from the session. So hopefully we won't have a technical hitch like that today.
All right. Let's hope so.
Everybody was very patient with me anyway. So.
I'll do.
Okay. Right. So Michael is here to talk about this subject of the know-nothing leader today. And I'm just going to introduce you, and then we'll get on to talking about this topic. And Michael has a great deal of expertise, is bringing a great deal of expertise to us today. So you have decades of experience, literally working in digital, driving digital transformation and culture change, and working on a global scale for that for organizations such as Gartner, GE, Bloomberg. And now you've really come over to the dark side, or is it the light side?
And your the light side.
Okay, you've given up that working as an organizational person and working independently, basically doing the same thing, and writing your book, which I'm hoping we'll hear a little bit more about as we go along today. But really, you know, it's not your expertise we're here to talk about today, which is interesting. So we're talking about the know-nothing leader. But how I like to introduce people here on the community is I like to talk about my connection with them. So I'm going to talk about how we know each other, basically. So I connected with you after hearing you on a podcast. We connected over a podcast and a book, which is my favorite way to connect with people. So you were on the podcast, The Coaching Habit with Michael Bungestania, which I listened to. And you were talking about this book here, which is one of the books you're talking about, which is Humility is the New Smart. And my virtual background doesn't like it when I do this, but it's Humility is a New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. And I rushed out to buy that book. And you mentioned the topic of the know-nothing leader. So I really connected. I was just starting out at that time around my self-doubt work. And I really connected with what you were saying, with the concept of what you were saying. And so I contacted you on LinkedIn, and we started chatting. And I say that you're my friend, but I also say you're my mentor, Michael, and that's not an official role, but really that's the role you've taken up for me, because you've given me a huge amount of time. You've given me a lot of encouragement in my work, and also you've given me advice and feedback, but only when I've asked for it. And, you know, so what that tells me is that this is probably your way of showing up in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that, you know, the subject we're going to talk about today is a way of being for you, and something that's deeply important and more of a way of being, because I've seen the way that you show up. So I'm really looking forward to digging into this subject with you. Is there anything else you think people need to know about you as way of introduction?
No, that was lovely and very kind of you. So thank you. No, you're right. We, you know, connected online there, and it's been, I would consider you my friend as well. And I've enjoyed having the friendship. I'm looking forward to the time actually when our meeting face-to-face actually is not on a camera. So one day we'll make that happen when I'm over in the UK or you're over in the States.
Yeah, one day. We're really used to this virtual environment though, aren't we? Aren't we
This is
lucky
true.
to have that familiarity? Okay, so the know-nothing leader. Leaders know nothing. Leaders that know nothing, is it really nothing they should know? Maybe just talk about this a little bit, introduce this concept to us a little bit.
Sure. Well, and yeah, it's meant to be a little bit provocative. There's nothing wrong with knowing things, but certainly, I think in the age that we live in now, and I think the concept was mentioned when I talked about that book, Ed and Catherine's book, "Humility is a New Smart," is that knowing, I think, is much more overrated than it than or then it has value anymore. I think they make a comment there that the shelf life of things that we know to be true now is about 3 years. So what I wanted to approach the world with is this idea of let's not start with what we know. Let's start with what we don't know. You and I both connected over my relationship with and the work I was doing with Michael Bungay's tenure of Box of Crayons, who's done a lot to really operationalize curiosity with the Coaching Habit and now his Advice Trap book, et cetera. I believe the same thing. We worked together, he and I, for over 15 years, and not knowing, stepping back from being sure, from having your assumptions and operating on those, into a place of saying, I don't know. I gotta step back and have a healthy doubt that what I know to be true or what my working assumption is still right. Otherwise, the day it's not right, I won't recognize that, and I'll move blithely forward with the wrong assumptions. So that's really kind of the idea behind it. And it probably, the genesis of it first came as there's many great things in the world, if you trace them back in this area to Ed Schein and his idea of accessing your ignorance when dealing with someone else, especially a consulting client. It's like, okay, I don't understand. I don't get that. I'm not sure it makes sense to me, as opposed to I'm going to pretend like I know, and that makes me look smart and professional.
Yeah, because I think the know nothing leader, if you see that title, you could easily assume that it would be like the other way, people I don't know, but I'm going to pretend I know anyway. And I think there's been a lot of examples of that out
Well,
there, which are
yeah, there certainly has. I
definitely
mean,
not.
it's oftentimes how leaders are taught to show up, right? I show up here. I've achieved this level of status, of wealth, of power, of respect because of all the things I know. And in a world where what you knew mattered the most, that was great. Now, in a world of, machines that can know more quicker and learn quicker, it's not what you know, it's how fast you learn to know new things and then relearn those things and relearn those things. So since the duration of knowing's value is getting shorter, it's about how quickly you learn, which is what Ed Hess and Catherine Ludwig talk about in that book. And so for me, the know-nothing leader is someone who embraces the idea of learning. But just calling it the learning leader just didn't sound near as interesting, did it?
Yeah, provocative, like you say, people are going to think, what's that? I've got this quote actually. It's interesting because I was just flicking through this book and I landed on this quote. So I'm going to read it out just for coincidence that you spoke about it. So he said, "What's left for humans to do? The humans can no longer add value by merely accumulating or analyzing knowledge. The creation of new knowledge is increasing exponentially and is now believed that most knowledge has less than 3 year shelf life." It's probably less by now. What you think you know is so quickly out of date that you must continually update your learning. So moreover, it will be impossible for humans to know more facts or concepts than a smart machine, or be able to process, remember, recall, pattern match, and synthesize more data faster or more accurately than smart machines. So it's really in the age of machine learning, artificial intelligence. And I think I mentioned on our synopsis that you and I have a shared belief that what we're seeing in digital transformation, what this is bringing us, is an opportunity for humans to operate from humanity.
Absolutely. I mean, it's and you've heard me, I think, make this comment, or I've certainly said it before. I stole it from a great friend of mine, but the fact that we're living in a world of fifth generation information technology and second generation human systems. I mean, and largely, if you look at organizations, and I'm going to sound a little bit dour here, maybe I don't mean to, but they were founded on the kind of, you know, Frederick Taylor school of thought of build the perfect machine, then populate with people and hope they don't get in the way. Just have the machine people do their tasks. They're a role. The humans are fungible. As long as they deliver and meet the goals for that task, you string all the tasks together and it's perfect. You get the product you want. It was based upon that, you know, industrial era. And it worked fabulously until it didn't. And when it stopped working is when we moved past a world that the problems we were solving were stable enough that you could set up a machine and a factory line to deliver an outcome, and the outcome and the product was what was needed every time. That was fine. Now it's not the case. I mean, the classic is, right, the, you know, a Ford, and we're going to make that car the same way every way and get that car out the door because all people want is a car. And really, as we begin to realize that what they wanted was a way to get from place to place, you know, most effectively, then things begin to change. Now the car manufacturers, it's not just do you make a car, it's how do you get people to move? Is that going to be through automatic driving? Is it going to be through, you know, auto ride sharing? What is it going to be? So the problems became much more complex, and the problems they're trying to solve became more complicated. So we had to look at, well, what does that mean for us as we're trying to figure out things based upon our knowledge? We have to actually say, okay, what don't we know about this, so we can figure out what the possible solutions are. And there's many of them, and they may change entirely how we solve them.
Yeah. There's a technology for, since the beginning of time, really has been, you know, overtaking humans at doing our jobs, isn't it? And now that's happening.
Yeah, it has. And it's been okay for us to say, you're a role, not a person. And I think that, you know, one of the things that the software revolution brought about was saying, actually, you're a person, not a role. It's interesting with all the move towards agile everywhere since it became popular. I think the biggest mistake people are making is they're putting in agile processes and saying, well, this is an agile process. We meet like this and we call this a scrum, et cetera. And okay, that's fine. You go back to the Agile Manifesto, it says, you know, people over process. It's about getting people together and having them figure it out, and having those people matter more than the role they're in, to say, look, here's an outcome we need. How do we rearrange who we are to get that done? Well, if we're going to arrange who we are, I have to know who you are. You have to know who I am, what we're capable of, not just the role we were put into. And so it becomes much more about our humanity. It's the same for our leaders as they now are leading. They used to have this, you know, I could command and control and get it done. That was my job. My job was to know the most and tell you what to do. Now my job has moved away from command and control to curiosity and conductor. I have to look for what we're missing, and I have to orchestrate people getting together, but let go of the control of what they're doing. I just have to help them organize and be together and connect with each other so they can do what they do and figure the rest of it out, which is in many ways very threatening to leaders who grew up in the last generation, you know, in my generation, because that's not what value is all about. And now they're a little bit lost in a world of new value.
Of course, we're talking about this really on a theoretical level, but you've been working with this this concept in a practical way. Could you say some of the ways and some of the challenges maybe that you've actually experienced around trying to bring you more humanity and more curiosity into your leadership style and helping others with their leadership styles as well?
Sure. Well, I think one of the most, actually, I was writing about this yesterday. One of the most insidious things is that I believe we have a tendency to, once we hear and understand something conceptually, you talked about it being theoretical, right? Once we get the theory, we think we have the practice. So it's like, okay, Michael, I buy this idea that I need to be more curious. I need to be more open. I need to be more, you know, aware of what people can do. And because I now believe that, I do one or two things. It's like, well, what do you think? And I do a couple of things that are at the very surface level. But then most of the time I'm operating just on old patterns and old, you know, kind of neural pathways. And I just keep doing it. But I've got this little patina of I'm doing something different over the top of it. Whereas I really haven't dug down in. I haven't been challenged. I haven't put the people in place, the coaches, the supporters, the people on my team who can call me out when I'm actually not being that curious person. I mean, one of my favorites, I've seen this so many times, is, you know, I'll say, how would you respond to this person? Well, I'd say, what you need to do is X, Y, Z. I said, okay, well, how about if you're going to be curious? You're right. I need to do this different. I'll be curious. Have you considered X, Y, Z? You know, is this the same directive, just kind of couched in a, let me tell you what the answer is in a nice questiony way so you can give it to me and feel better about yourself. But it doesn't change anything. They know what you're doing, so they give you the answer you want because you have control over resources or something else. But we feel like we've changed. So I think, you know, to answer your question, hopefully a little more concisely, is that we feel like we've changed because we understand the need for it, but we haven't done the hard work to change.
Yeah. So it's about, and this is, so what we see a lot of is lip service in organizations, and particularly around, well, the area I'm quite interested in, which is diversity and inclusion, can be very, oh, the buzzwords, and okay, are we doing this inclusion like thing on the side, but it can become lip service. So how do we get beyond that, doing it at the surface? You know, that feels like the real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, take inclusion. And again, I hope I don't offend anyone here, but just because you put an inclusion role in place and hire a female of color into it doesn't mean you've got, you know, inclusion and diversity. Now, if you understand the value of having more females and more people of color on your team, then you're moving towards real diversity. Just getting the mix to look right doesn't do anything. But if you understand that, you know, in general, which is a horrible thing for me being a male, but women as a whole tend to make better, more thoughtful decisions than men, especially when they're more of them in the group. In fact, the one thing that always improves in business results is the quality of decision-making when there's more and more women on a leadership team. But, you know, why is that? Women look at the world, and again, this is a gross generalization based upon gender, but generally some of the early research a little bit differently. Their sense of morality isn't one of, I take a given situation and work with it. It's, what if the situation's wrong? Which is a great thing of stepping back before taking a given situation and working with it. So, I think that, you know, that stuff on the surface is, we put, again, the layer that looks right, but then we don't stop to do the work and ask why it matters. I don't stop to think, it's a question I have with my wife. I said, you know, I think that I'm someone who has not been, you know, sexist or done anything to make anyone who works for me who's female uncomfortable, but I've never actually asked. I mean, so was there something I did that I missed? Was there some way that I acted that was even subtle? Because when you're in a world where, you know, there's a lot of these patterns that can really build up, you might react more to something subtle that I don't know that I'm doing. So I have to do the hard work to ask, how was that? Did that work? Did that not work? And I have to make sure people feel safe to give me that feedback. And then I have to be willing to listen to it and not get caught up in, you know, any kind of shame because I did something wrong. I need to say, great, now I can learn from that. And those are hard things to do. They take work, they take effort. And you know what? They don't feel like work. Work feels like getting stuff done, like doing things that fit the KPIs. It doesn't feel like digging deeper into who I am and how I interact with other human beings and how I impact them that I don't know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And I think you probably touched on one of the things that I certainly recognize from my time in organizations, which is a while ago now, but the thing that gets in the way of all this stuff is the drive for productivity and efficiency and getting stuff done. Yeah. And often, particularly I was working SME environments when, you know, they weren't so good on this stuff, really, the human side of it, really, often. So it was that drive for efficiency. So what would you say about that? I mean, you as a leader and somebody who is driving strategy, you know, how would you try to overcome that?
Well, I think that it's not So as you know, we've talked a little bit about the book that I'm writing. The Heart of Transformation is the working title, Building the Human Capabilities That Change Organizations for Good. And when I talk about these capabilities, I'll give an example based upon one of the ones that we've been talking about, learning over knowing. Now, it's not just learning, it's learning over knowing. And it's not just learning not knowing. The point is that you need to know things. There's nothing wrong with knowing things, but you have to be constantly in learning mode to make sure what you know still has a little bit of shelf life left, right? Another one is exploring over executing, or, you know, I mean, I work in so many organizations that's execution, 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 but then they find all of a sudden that they're executing brilliantly on the wrong thing because the world has changed around them so suddenly and they haven't paid attention because they're so focused on execution. However, if you do some exploring, figure out that it's still the right thing, you adjust where you're going, you adjust what you're executing on, you still keep doing it. You don't, you know, abandon it. So I think that organizations, we're not saying be inefficient, we're not saying be unproductive, but we are saying that you really have to have ways to make sure that this efficiency isn't costing you elsewhere, that this productivity isn't at the cost of, you know, people. And there's so many things that can shift and change and go wrong, especially in a world where, you know, our human capital, which I really kind of loathe the word. It's like I spent most of my career in human resources, and I can't mm-hmm. stand the term because they're not human resources. They're people. They're individuals. They're not resources to be moved around. And we need to understand that. We need to engage with them as human beings, as individuals. We need to share what the problems are, and then we need to work together to solve them, as opposed to deploy these people to solve things. And so much of our ways of management are built upon arranging, ordering, and deploying people like things. And again, that worked when things were relatively stable. It worked well enough for the people in charge. Didn't always work so well for the people doing the work. but they didn't really have much of a choice. Now we're in a world where people have much more choice. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, would I have been able to leave a well-paying corporate executive role and just start doing my own thing and forming my own company? No, there wouldn't have been any platform for that. But now there is a platform. I'm talking to you today. You'll have this on your channel. I'll have it on my channel. It'll go out via social media. And it will be one more thing that builds my presence in the market, which makes me a viable entity all on my own, which again is, you know, changing things for corporations. Sorry, mm-hmm. I felt like I got a little bit lost and mixed there. I'm not sure if that's where you wanted me to go.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I'm just taking in what you're saying. And so I think what I'm curious about is really, you know, why have you come into this personally, into this way of working? Because, you know, you talked about being that C-level leader, you know, you're a white male of a certain age, you know, have that kind of innate privilege, let's say. You know, I know that we all have privilege, we all have disadvantage, we're not really here to talk about that, but you know, it probably would have been easy for you just to kind of ride the wave and do what you know and, you know, take home the pay packet and build your pension and ride out your career. But you've not chosen that route. I wonder if you could say something about that.
Sure. Well, for me, it just, maybe it goes back to, I was, when I was at Gartner years ago, we used to do a lot of work with the Gallup organization and their consulting side, you know, with around StrengthsFinder and all of that. But I was talking to one of their lead research scientists named Rod Wagner, who's now out on his own. But he talked about their hiring into the consulting organization. And there was a question that they would ask people when they were hiring, and they were very, very selective. And basically they'd say, "What's your mission?" And if you didn't have an answer that was useful and fairly ready, they figured you really didn't know who you wanted to be. And when he asked me that question, he goes, "I'll ask you, Michael, what's your mission?" I said, "To make the world a better place to live and work, one organization at a time." And I had never vocalized that before, but it was right there and I knew what it was. So as I moved through my career, that never left me. And I was doing it one organization at a time by being in those organizations. And then I found that I was having a harder and harder time making the world a better place to work and live, even in senior roles, because of so many of the things culturally in organizations that needed to change. And I went in to try and be an instrument of change within those organizations and found, for me at least, that the expectations for a role were crushing and strangling. But to ask the human resources department to be creative enough to put it into a different type of role or leave the role more diffuse or unsettled completely overwhelmed them with, oh, we can't do that. So it really wasn't effective inside organizations. And that's kind of what led me to go outside, is to pursue my own vision for, what I want to do in the world. And for some, it happens inside an organization, and, God bless them, more power to them. We need those people. It just wasn't for me.
It sounds like you're really driven by a set of values there about making the world a better place to work and live.
Yeah, I'd like to be. I mean, we all, I think, I'd like to feel we make some contribution to the world. And my first job, real job out of college, was I worked for the social services agency, the welfare department in Southern California, one of the counties there. And it was the most, I mean, just mind-numbing, soul-sapping thing I've ever done in my life. But it gave me an incredible insight into just about as dysfunctional as an organization could be. And learning from that, I realized how painful, how dehumanizing, how humiliating, how frustrating work could be. And I was fresh out of college. There are people that have been there for 35, 40 years that had been their work life. And it horrified me. And I thought, there's got to be something that can be done to make places like this better. Now, thankfully, most organizations weren't as bad as the one that I worked on. I hope that organization isn't that bad anymore. They eventually went bankrupt as a county, and so maybe they got completely new leadership than they had at the time, which was, anyway. but the fact of the matter is that, making the world a better place to live and work, because they're both so important and so interconnected now, felt like something that I might be able to have an impact on. And so I put my educational, bets there, and put my occupational bets there, and that's the way that I've gone and stuck with it, because it makes me feel like I'm giving something, back to the world I live in, as opposed to just taking from it. Because as you've mentioned, and this has dawned on me over my career, I've got a lot of privilege. I'm a white American cisgendered male, who was raised by very thoughtful parents, who had, opportunities, who has fallen into a part of the world where, financial opportunities are very great. So if I've got all those advantages that have been given to me by just the luck of the draw, I shouldn't think that that makes me special, that makes me obligated.
And I love that example that you bring and talk about that, because we all have privileges. I talk about this in I touch on this in my book. We all have privilege, but we all have disadvantage as well. We all have areas where we feel disadvantaged, and I guess it's knowing how best to use that privilege to give something back is a and that's a wonderful example, and I thank you for bringing that.
Sure.
You talked about the challenge of working in organizations, and as you talk about how stifling it can be, I remember back to my days working in organizations where I didn't have a choice. And I've been given choices. This is my privilege now. Me and my husband, well, we've made our choices, and
Yeah.
we've chosen not to. He's
And your
pretty much,
sacrifices.
yeah, with sacrifice, that's right. Well, he's pretty much unemployable anyway. He would admit that. I'm not so, but anyway. It's nice and not having to work in organisations, but it takes me back to being in that environment, which can be quite stifling, the politics, the egos at play, because not everybody wants to step up to that mission of making the world a better place. There's a lot of people out there who want to line their own pockets, and this is just the world we live in. And what would you say to somebody who's perhaps in a position who maybe not driving strategy so much, but maybe more in a middle management position, who is feeling that they have an expectation to know and to perform and to produce and to be productive and all that kind of stuff, all that kind of that stifling expectation.
Yeah.
but would like to really bring more humanity into their work and into their life and make their organization a better place to be. What would you say?
Well, I think a couple of things come to mind, and I used to work, it was part of the work I did in one organization. There were a series of metrics and activities that the leadership in the organization decided they wanted to accomplish because that drove results. I had a lot of people that worked on my team who didn't believe that those things actually drove results. And I'll be honest, I was absolutely in line with them. It was one of those sets of, you know, things that came down from the top leadership that actually were kind of poorly informed, but nobody had challenged them. But they weren't something we could just make go away overnight. We couldn't just stop doing what was being asked of us. You know, so you could take your ball and go home, I guess. What we talked about is, well, what's the minimum, levels of success that you can have in those things to, you know, check the box, minimum level specifications. How do you get those things done? And how do you do them good enough? Working with Michael Bungay Stanier at Box of Crayons, we used to talk about that with our people and say, look, don't do things that, you know, have to be done given the role you're in, but that don't engage you at all. You don't think you're valuable. Don't say, well, this is a stupid thing to do. It doesn't make any sense. It has no value, but I'm going to do 6 drafts of it to make sure it's perfect, so I look good. Don't do that. Do it good enough. I mean, and we'd say, you know, do something adequately. People go, adequate? I would never do anything adequate. Why not? What does adequate mean? Well, good enough. That's it. Adequate means good enough, and good enough is good enough. So you're always going to find yourself with things in a given role, or potentially you will, unless you, you know, completely, you know, leave. And even now I find myself doing things that, you know, I need to do that don't really hit my sweet spot, don't get me excited or engage me. But I do them good enough, and that meets the need, and that not putting more than good enough into them gives me the time to do things elsewhere. I guess this is a lesson that really first crystallized for me working with Michael in his book, Do More Great Work. I mean, I really ascribe to that belief is, you know, figure out what your great work is and know there's some good work, even a little bit of bad work out there. Manage it the right way so you have more time for the great work. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think, you know, I've got a couple of people on here who I've particularly invited today to listen to you talk about this. So I'm hoping that maybe they'll come on and maybe talk into that a little bit more. I feel like kind of part of what you're saying is getting beyond ego, getting beyond the ego that is, well, for me, how it operated, particularly in my earlier career, was that I didn't feel I was good enough, so I had to prove something. I felt like I had something to prove. And so that proving came out in very annoying ways, I'm really sure. I mean, I used to do really good work. I used to really get a good job done, but I don't think I was a very pleasant person to work with all the time. That's the truth. I became aware of what I was doing, and I became aware that operating from ego is not a comfortable or nice place to be at work. And I think a lot of it was getting beyond that, doing a job that's good enough, but, you know, saving the energy for the other stuff that's more important.
Well, and I wonder if it's doing it out of ego or out of just, you know, fear that you won't be able to keep up the thing that makes you feel good about yourself, that I'm not quite good enough, or I'm, you know, again, back to your concept of, you know, self-doubt, that I'm not enough. I've seen so many people, and I've done it myself as well, over-deliver on things that don't really matter because they thought that's what the boss was asking for, but they never actually clarified, is that what you really need or want? Which for me is why, you know, if you're going to do things good enough, I guess there's a implied in that that you have to find out what good enough is. And there's a discipline of going back and asking, oh, so do you need this? Do you want this? As opposed to saying, I'm just going to throw the kitchen sink at it and waste a tremendous amount of time and energy and sacrifice things elsewhere to give you everything I think you need. Find out what they need. Ask. It's not going to hurt. And say, hey, do we need this or that and that? I was going to do this way. Does that work? They'll probably be appreciative of the fact that you're being creative. You're thinking about it. You're clear that you want to give them what they need. So clear, in fact, that you're going to go back and really you know, eye to eye do that with them as opposed to spinning your wheels. It reminds me of a, there was a famous story back at Gartner from way beyond the current CEO, Gene Hall, some of one of his predecessors. And it was in the age of, for those of you who remember, the age of everything was on the voicemail. And you would add to voicemails and you'd enter a voicemail and forward that voicemail on. There's all these voicemail groups. It was all exciting. And at one point, the CEO said something about, I wish we had I could just like push one button and send a voicemail to the entire company. And he made this comment in a group of people. And 18 months later, they rolled out this new voicemail system and it got huge complaints because it dropped a ton of functionality that was very useful to the business. And so he called the CIO and said, what did you do here? We did what you wanted. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, we know you said you wanted the ability to do that, but there's no other solutions that did this without getting rid of all these things. So we had to do it. And he goes, I was talking out loud. God, do not listen to me without challenging. Do not listen to me and think that my musing is some sort of directive. But people will do that. He mused out loud on something and they didn't. Nobody came back to him and said, hey, we can do that for you and get rid of a tremendous amount of productive features that add to the business. Is that okay? They just gave him what he wanted, which you know, cost them tens of thousands of dollars to fix.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. So it comes really down to communication. And
yeah.
And as you're talking through that, you know, I'm thinking we're both coaches and we both, coaching is really a way of being around communication. And you know, my most recommended book is Michael Pongestania's The Coaching Habit. It's brilliant. Anybody who's on this call who hasn't read it, I do recommend it because it is those really, really basic questions, but also it's very profound actually around the coaching skills it includes in that book. It's very easy to think that it's very simple, but you know, and these kind of questions and ways of being can really help, I think, with this type of communication.
Yeah. I mean, as I say in the book, I'll admit that, you know, the idea of questions changing everything, you know, Ed Schein talked about that. Peter Block talked about that. Michael Pongestania certainly has, I think, operationalized and popularized it so much, especially in the frame of being more coach-like. But it is an art that's been around for a while, but continues to get lost, which is the art of asking the question. And as a sneak preview, in the book that I'm writing, all of these more human capabilities that we're looking at, the thing that I'm hoping makes the book different is I don't stop by saying you should be this, you should be X, Y, or Z, and then you have to go off and figure it out on your own. It boils it down to what are some of the behaviors, i.e. what are some of the questions I should ask that help me be that kind of person? And then it talks about how you, you know, learn from that as well so you can continue to improve. But that's all it's really about. I mean, having great questions. And one of the things we'll talk about as well is how do you come up with great questions? If we spent much more time thinking about what's the question or two I want to ask, as opposed to how do I want to show up? How do I want to look? How do I want to make sure I appear? How much knowledge do I want to display? If we could just get into knowing nothing and saying, okay, I need to ask a couple of things. Let me spend most of my time figuring out where I'm most ignorant, where I know the least, and start to ask those questions, or where we as a group know the least. The power of questions is amazing, but it's almost too simple that people say, no, I need a different answer. And it's also, they struggle with it because it leaves it up to them to figure it out. You can give some guidance. I'll give some specific questions in what I do. Michael gives some great questions. I mean, the coaching habit is about 7 different questions and getting in the habit of using them. But once you've started to use those, you start to see, now I need to look at the world through the lens of what's the question?
Yeah. Well, that gives us a really neat little segue, actually, into questions. We've got a few people on the call today, and I'm going to invite people to come on if anybody's got any questions that they would like to bring to Michael or any observations. You can see that Kat has unmuted herself. Kat, do you want to put your camera on as well?
Yay, it worked.
Yay, well done.
So, hello. So, Olivia, Thank you so much for arranging this. Michael, you are just so the perfect person for me to be listening to at the moment for what I'm going through. So basically, as my little debacle there with trying to get myself on video here kind of shows, I'm a digital transformation project manager and program manager, and I know nothing about anything technical. So it's really lovely to hear you basically putting into words the way that I feel project management and program management and change and transformation needs to work. So it's really lovely to know that actually that's not just what I think, that's an actual thing.
Yep.
It's fabulous. It's actually really lovely to hear it, that it's an actual skill. And I suppose because I've spent so much of my life, I always thought I had something wrong with me because I was a jack of all trades and it was all about soft skills being what I was good at. And, you know, knowing what people were thinking somehow, or, you know, or asking people questions to find out these things. And so it's lovely to know that actually this is a skill in itself and the skills within that. So I suppose what I want now is I want to be useful, but I don't know what my use is, which can feel very frustrating and saddening.
Yeah.
But I think that you've started helping me by making me realise what poor Olivia has been trying to tell me for, 3 years or something, that there are skills that I have that I can't see are important and useful.
Yeah.
And I want the freedom to be able to do it on my own terms. So I don't want to be stuck in this corporate ladder with all the constraints. And so I wanted to ask you if you have any advice on where I can go from here to ask the right questions of myself and my surroundings, or maybe of what my mission is, to start getting to see what the next step is for how I can possibly use what I'm good at to help people.
Sure. Well, and I guess I would be... It would be almost a hypocritical of me to start giving you lots of advice without just giving some questions. you know, and one of the great questions is, you know, to think about really is what do you want? And, you know, it may be that you want to really make an impact in the corporate role you have other than you've been able to, or shift the focus of it, or maybe that you want to go and do this somewhere else or from the outside. You know, for me, what I found is that I had to learn enough of the language and the vocabulary of the technology and business that I could build a relationship. And once I had that relationship, then I could take it to a different place. But I couldn't just show up always as me and the stuff that I wanted to do that was maybe more on the people side or the soft side without giving respect and due to what it was that these people were living with and dealing with every day, because I knew I was going to be bringing something new to them and it was going to sound soft. And I could share it. I actually did a interview with a client of mine, with a guy named Hilton Barbour, B-A-R-B-O-U-R. He's out of Toronto, and he does a lot of work on culture. And my client, Terry, who I've worked with some time, we met at Gartner, is the CEO of a technology company. And we talk about how I kind of started out as the wide-eyed, people-ish HRE guy, and he was, you know, the hardcore business and marketing and operations guy. And we sort of met together in the middle over time. But that one of the things that we had to do is I had to show him that I understood this before he would let me in and help him, you know, go in this direction as well. So I think that's, you know, one thing I would potentially share is, you know, what is the common ground that you connect on, and what do they need to know that you know just enough about in the technology, not more so, might be a way to start that conversation. Is that useful?
It is, yes. I think I've got a lot further to go on questioning, and Olivia will help me with all of that, I'm sure, now that I've had to hear it from someone else what she's been trying to tell me.
Well, that what do you want question, you know, is a great one, and it takes some time to figure out, and that's certainly okay. to take your time with that one. And it's okay, I think, to be, I've been in some roles that, like I mentioned at the beginning, that were horrible roles for me, but I learned from them. And so if we say, look, I'm not going to do this forever, this is not right, it's not quite on, but what's the thing I can learn about myself, what I know, what I don't know, what I need to know, how I'm coming across, how I'm, you know, what are my blind spots? There's so many opportunities for learning in any role that we're in that I think helps us find that next role, because we sometimes find ourselves in this place of, this is not the right place for me, but we don't know what is. And so getting more clear on why it's not sometimes helps us find the one that is.
I'll tell you what I love about what Kat does, actually, because she brings real creativity to her work in project management and program management. And she's worked in some sectors which are very, well, she's working in digital transformation, but she worked in construction before. Mm. And I think it's really easy to undervalue those kind of soft, more creative skills where, you know, I mean, you know, I have to say she wouldn't be in these roles if she wasn't able to do the program and the you know, the hard stuff as well.
Yeah.
But I think what she really, what Kat desires to bring more of is that creative, fun side of her. And I think what we're saying here is about how, you know, organizations need more of this now, right? Because, yeah, you know, all that kind of the productivity and the prediction stuff, that's all going to be done by the machines now. And so what do we bring? Well, our creativity and our humanity, our intuition, our empathy, that kind of stuff. That's our advantage. That's our human advantage nowadays. So yeah, I think more and more these skills are required, aren't they?
I agree. And maybe for, you know, for Kat, you know, and others here is that, I've often said that our minds are often smarter than we are, and we'll have this reaction to something like, "Is, well, what were you thinking?" or "Why on earth would you do that?" And those actually aren't questions, right? They're judgments, which is saying you were not thinking at all, or there's no reason to do that. But if you step away from your judgment, your mind actually had the right question. If you can pull away and actually change the judgment to curiosity and say, "Oh, so why did you do that? Or what were you thinking here?" Then you can actually engage someone in a way that isn't insulting, and you can actually find out. And that is an opening sometimes, because if they say, "Ah, I don't even know," or they start exploring, then you get into this mutual exploration together. You'll find you can bring some of those gifts, those things, those knowledge, the pieces of knowledge that you have, your way of looking at the world. If you take, you know, the frustration and the judgment away from it and just put the curiosity and the care into it, the words are often exactly the same, and the ones that you need to use to start to engage people differently, even in the context of what's going on for them, so it doesn't seem so foreign or out of left field.
It's interesting you talk about changing judgment to curiosity, because I'm writing about that at this moment in my book. That's going to come out. We've come up to 10 to. I'm just going to see, does anybody else really want to come on and ask Michael a question? Are you willing to come on while the recording's on? Because this is a great benefit of the people who can't, who are stuck in organisations, are stuck to desks. You know, if they get to hear your questions. Jay's come on. Brilliant.
Hey, guys. Michael, thanks for that. It's fantastic. It's just a quick thank you. You literally, in real time, you just give me permission to not obsess. I'm sitting here on my website and I'm obsessing and obsessing and obsessing. And then he said it and it triggered me. And I was like, yep, the man knows. So just to thank you for that. I do know that, but struggle with it. So thanks for the reminder.
Ah, pleasure. I'm glad it was useful. As people who know me will realize that one of the greatest compliments I think is that that was useful. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
We will have some time when we cut off, hopefully, for anybody who doesn't want to come on the recording. If anybody does, you know, just feel free to unmute yourself. For people who might be listening to the recording but who can't contribute, who can't come along because you've got day jobs you can't get away from, you can contribute to these sessions. There's a link in every email I sent out which takes you to the contribution section of my website, and you can ask me anything. Or say something, or you can tell me where self-doubt is showing up in your life, and we will bring those contributions to the community and pick them apart. And hopefully you'll get some value like that if you can't attend.
And Olivia, if I may, you know, people who want to reach out, my business, Silverback Partners, it can be found at silverbackpartners.net. You can just check me out there or email me, michael@silverbackpartners.net. And of course, like many of us, I've got a lot of things doing, going on that I'm involved in, but I do try and connect. I mean, as a result here, you know, you reached out of the blue, but, you had, a thoughtful, intelligent question and a nice opening, and that's, you know, turned into a friendship. So I'm always happy to have people reach out. Certainly I will respond and I'll do what I can. I certainly can't do everything, but these are always a great way just to broaden our circles and meet other people. And, you know, who knows where that's going to lead. I have a friend, a mutual friend, Dori Clark, who, you know, said once when I was listening, had her speak at a Gartner event, she said, talk to somebody every day that you might not normally talk to, and just have that conversation, whatever it may be, the person on the plane, the person on the bus, of course, not right now, I think it's the person on the video, but, you know, reach out, have those conversations and see where it goes. You know, the worst thing can happen when you reach out to someone is they say, I don't have time right now, or I don't have time, you know, so you're no worse off than when you started, but the best case scenario, who knows, it could turn into a friendship.
Yeah, definitely. And a testament here, because I reached out to you like that. And thank you for that. And just to say, Michael, you will have your book coming out in the near future, and you're starting to do some content now as well, which is always really great to see.
A lot more on my YouTube channel and a lot more content. I've got someone who's better at that than me, who is, you know, kicking my behind on a daily basis. If you're watching this, thank you, Faye.
Your dominatrix.
FayesWorld.com. She's great.
your dominatrix, isn't she?
That's right. Unfortunately, I call her that. So they crack the whip on me, boss. But she's wonderful. But those of you who are interested in getting help on marketing, if that's what you do, her website, it's FEISWorld, FayesWorld.com. And she's wonderful. She's helped me do so much.
Okay, we're going to kick off the record now, but don't go, people. If you want to stay, we'll hang around for a few minutes so we can have another chat. And Michael, just stay for as long as you can, or, you know, feel free to go if you need to. So just before I sign off, you know, thank you so much again, Michael, for coming on today. It's been a real pleasure to talk this through with you. And I'm really looking forward to seeing more of your work come out. Next week, we're going to start getting a bit vulnerable next week. I'm going to start a series of episodes on the strength of weakness. And next week, I've got somebody, Paul Collins, coming on, and he is a yoga master. And we're going to talk about his work in healing trauma, but also the work that I've done with him around the strength of weakness. So these kind of weak, soft skills we're talking about here, and how they are actually, they're not weak, soft skills at all. So we're going to be going there with that. So thank you, everybody, for joining me today. Thank you, Michael.
Pleasure.
I'm going to turn off the recording now, and see you next week.